One hates to say this, but sometimes one has to do what one has to do. This might be as good as it gets economically for a while, gang. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you along, everybody, as it always is. It's the 22nd of December today, Tuesday. Without trying to sound all highbrow about it, there's a phrase I need to run by you as a way to set up the news of the day as we see it. Secular stagnation is what I'm talking about. The idea, well, the reality, actually, that we're stuck in a cycle of modest economic growth with little inflation, and that's just the way it is. No big external influences. We're just stuck. I mention it because this morning the Commerce Department finished crunching the numbers for the third quarter. Gross domestic product, GDP, it's called, an imperfect but still important measure of the economy, grew at a rate of 2%, down slightly from earlier guesses. Perhaps not a surprise, given that GDP growth since January 2011, that is going on 5 years now, has averaged 2%. So, getting back to that idea of secular stagnation, what if this is the best we can hope for a while? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson takes a look.
We can think about 2% growth in GDP as, hey, 2%, or it could be just 2%.
So it's not bad news, but it's not good news either, right?
Ann Owen is an economics professor at Hamilton College. Modest is sort of the key word here. Modest GDP growth means modest increases in everything else, from interest rates to wages. Owen says the thing to watch if this continues is who gets those wage increases.
When we have really big increases in GDP, typically everybody sees an increase. When we have more modest increases, it becomes more of a concern that everybody is not seeing the increases.
And even though wage increases will be modest, Ken Goldstein, an economist at the Conference Board, doesn't think prices will rise as fast. He says that'll pinch companies' profits, which will limit their investments.
Basically, all investment these days, on a business point of view, is for repair and replacement. It's not really for upgrade and expansion.
And that's what could lead to more growth. Kevin Jakes, a professor at Baldwin Wallace University, says that's also keeping hiring modest.
You're not going to be necessarily hiring as many workers as you otherwise would have if the economy was growing faster. To some degree, it's become self-reinforcing.
So, yeah, the Conference Board's Ken Goldstein says, get used to 2%, maybe a little higher.
At least for now, and it ain't that bad.
Especially compared with Europe and Japan. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Ain't that bad. Fabulous. All right, a story now about recycling, hardware recycling to be specific. Really big and really cool hardware to get right down to it. I don't know if you've seen the video. If you haven't, we've got a link on our website. But last night, SpaceX, Elon Musk's rocket company, launched its Falcon 9 rocket carrying a payload of communication satellites and this is where it gets cool, honestly, then landed that booster back on the ground. Aside from the sheer rocketeering amazingness, it means that instead of just blasting stuff into space, SpaceX can reuse stuff that costs millions of dollars to make, saving them and their customers some serious money. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that story from Washington.
With the landing of Falcon 9, SpaceX got the edge on its competitor, Blue Origin. They've been racing to be the first to reuse their rockets. Safely landing them can save the company a lot of money.
There's potential to reduce launch costs substantially, maybe as much as 75%.
Carissa Christensen is managing partner at the consulting firm Tory Group. She says the cost savings could be passed on to companies hitching rides on those rockets, like those making weather and communication satellites.
I'm not sure your cable bill is going down, but there could be effects on that industry.
That's if it doesn't cost too much to get the rockets up and running again. SpaceX could still save millions, but not nearly as much. NASA learned that the hard way with its space shuttle program.
The shuttle is sort of a cautionary tale.
Ray Sedgwick teaches aerospace engineering at the University of Maryland.
So I hope that they've both considered sort of the potential pitfalls associated with the refurbishment process.
He says if these private companies can get the tech right, it could change the commercial space industry.
that's why it's really great that there are two companies that are working on this at the same time.
With the stiff competition between Blue Origin and SpaceX, a ride to space could get a lot cheaper. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Wall Street had a little bit of a liftoff today. See what I did there? Green across the board on the major indices. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We do corporate profits all the time on this program. All right, maybe not all the time, but once a quarter or so when earnings reports come out. Here, though, is a government report that's going to affect a whole lot of companies. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says net farm income is going to show a nearly 40% drop this year, 40% when all the totals are in. That's the biggest year-over-year drop in more than three decades. It'll affect farm equipment makers, food and grain companies, livestock and ranchers, you and me as well. Marketplace's Annie Baxter went to see how it's playing out in the farm fields of southern Minnesota.
A couple months ago, this farmer, Bruce Schmall, was trying to wrap up his corn and soybean harvest. But things were not exactly going as planned.
What was wrong over there? Blew the circuit breaker on the leg. Opened it up, and all of a sudden the pit belt started smoking. So
that news came from Schmall's cousin, who also said that the front tires on one of the trucks needed air. Schmall seemed exasperated.
Yeah, I know, but I like this, getting instructions from guys I hire.
The fields behind him, they were mostly harvested or dotted with stubble. But it was raining, so Schmall couldn't finish the job. And the damp weather meant there was another chore. They had to dry the corn that had already been harvested in this huge dryer.
One of the hazards of farming, you think you're going to have everything ready to go and something always happens.
The even bigger thing out of Bruce Schmall's control right now is the price he can get for the corn and soybeans he grows. Prices for those crops have been dropping for about 3 years now, and they're now down about 50% from their 2012 peaks. And for a while, those price drops were manageable because farmers were still making money, but now the price of corn is below the break-even point for a lot of farmers. That takes a toll.
I'm pretty sure every farmer is going to see quite a drop in their net income this year.
The Department of Ag predicts that could be as much as a 40% drop. The issue is that the world is awash in crops like corn, wheat, and soybeans. Supply just exceeds demand. And American farmers are also hurt by a strong dollar. It makes their products more expensive and less attractive. Livestock and dairy producers are seeing similar problems. This all trickles down to the companies that cater to farmers.
Meet the new 9RX Series tractor from John Deere.
Our business is so tied to the viability of our farmer customers. It's we go as they go.
Jacob Veldman sells John Deere equipment in the town of Owatonna. It's a dozen miles from where Bruce Schmall farms. Veldman says business was going great over the past few years. Farmers were making good money, and they were spending it on high-tech harvesting equipment and tractors. These are machines that can cost $250,000 and up.
We had people who would basically replace their whole line of equipment every year.
But now Veldman's business is down about 20%, and the lot outside his office has way too many machines sitting there for sale.
That's the scary part to me, because with the equipment values dropping as the crop prices dropped, we're just not able to move them fast enough.
The lower crop prices are also on the minds of bankers who lend to farmers.
Yeah, I think most banks are viewing the ag sector with some degree of caution.
Ron Feldman is a banking regulator at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. He says some farmers are struggling to pay their current debts. He says if crop prices bounce back next year, those financial problems may turn out not to be a big deal. But if crop prices don't rebound,
then at least some portion of this, you know, subset of borrowers are going to have a, you know, either a big restructuring of their loan or are not going to be able to pay back some portion of it.
Feldman says one thing that might help farmers is lowering their costs, like on the rent they pay for their land. But that would mean less money in the pockets of people like Dick Murray. He's 84, and he's Bruce Schmall's landlord.
Well, I have to probably lower the rent, and that's going to cut into our golden years, I guess you'd call it.
Murray says he's used to these ups and downs. He was a farmer himself for 60-some years. So for now, at least, the cuts he'll have to make to his own budget seem charmingly small. What kinds of things do you folks tend to spend money on in those parts?
Well, we don't go go out and eat that often. You might want to have nice filet steak, but you can do without it too.
So we'll have to clean up when we get done.
Back on Bruce Schmall's farm, he and his crew put some of this year's corn harvest into storage. I asked whether the lower prices will cut into his golden years, maybe push back his retirement. He is 62, and it sounds like retirement is on his mind.
And so I'm thinking, okay, how much longer do I want to work at this? And especially in Minnesota, when you've got conditions like this, it's cold and windy and rainy.
Even with all the highs and lows, he says for now, he's sticking with it. In Claremont, Minnesota, I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
We were down in Memphis, Tennessee yesterday for our election series, My Economy. We were there in part because of FedEx and its ginormous hub in Memphis, a million packages a night this time of year, an operation that makes Memphis the busiest airport in the world after dark. It's just a slice of a global and logistically mind-boggling system, the smooth running of which, arguably, comes down to 15 people, the meteorologists. I talked to two of them, Corey Gempler and Eric Procius.
Most meteorologists are bitten by the weather bug at a young age. Growing up in Minnesota, I just was impressed by storms and winter storms. Most people grow out of that, but some people continue and move to the next level and go to college and get a degree or go into the military.
We're the expert scientists for the company. So we provide the information about what we expect the weather to do in, for instance, Shanghai, you know, if it's a typhoon that's moving in or whatever. You know, in the United States, there's a lot of options with multiple airports that we serve that we can get freight closer to that city and have it ready when the weather improves.
We operate out of this control center 24 hours, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. We provide forecast for the dispatchers in the room, and so we support them and also the pilots. We issue routine and ad hoc forecasts to help move airplanes and goods around the world.
A forecaster comes on shift. They're responsible for a region of the United States, the north or the south portion of the country. And so a busy day would be a day where we've got multiple weather systems moving across the country, low clouds and fog, precipitation, winds at multiple locations. So I would be responsible for somewhere around 20 to 25 cities that I would write routine forecasts for on that shift. You know, if all 25 of them I have to think about pretty intently and look at the model data, then it's going to take me a lot longer than if I've got clear skies overhead for many of them. I don't sit around watching the Weather Channel at home. It does tend to improve the forecast accuracy if you look out the window once in a while. But we got radars that tell us what's going on, too.
Corey Gempler and Eric Procius work in the meteorology desk at FedEx's World Hub in Memphis, Tennessee on, I should tell you, a glorious sunny day. Coming up.
That may be why we're selling so many, because like I never wear out because nobody knows who I am.
Well, you're gonna now. You've heard his music, even though you might not know it. Chip Davis, the man, the mystery behind Mannheim Steamroller. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 165 points, 0.9%, closed at 17,417. The Nasdaq up 32 points, 0.6%, 5,001. The S&P 500 up 17 points, 0.8%, 2,038. We mentioned that successful SpaceX rocket launch up at the top. Satellites placed in orbit on that flight were from Orbcomm, which soared more than 10% higher today. Also in the aerospace industry, Lockheed Martin boosted 0.9%. Boeing ticked up 1%. There are reports that Ford and Google might team up to build self-driving cars. The automaker would not confirm it. We should say Ford cruised 3 and 4 tenths percent higher anyway. Google's parent company, Alphabet, clicked up 0.8%. If cinnamon whiskey is your adult beverage of choice around the holidays, first of all, why? But second of all, because it's my job, there is this news. Sazerac, maker of Fireball cinnamon whiskey, dropped a trademark infringement lawsuit against Jack Daniel's. Brown-Forman, owner of the Jack Daniel's label, tipped up 1.5%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is listener-supported. To keep our coverage relevant and compelling, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount supports your daily dose of business insight from Marketplace, so please help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders for November. Candy canes, not a durable good. 102 years ago, on December 23, 1913, President Woodrow Wilson signed the Federal Reserve Act, creating the Federal Reserve System. And sick of the commercialization of the season? You may be celebrating Festivus. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Retailers put loads, and I do mean loads of money, into figuring out new and different ways to get us to buy more stuff. A lot of that money goes toward manipulating our senses. Bright colors, pleasant smells, also music. Loud pop music seems to be the de facto soundtrack for most stores around the world. But what do you suppose is best for actual business? The BBC's arts correspondent David Sillitoe visited a mall in Birmingham, England, that's looking to change the way shopping sounds.
It is in so many places the sound of shopping. This particular pop soundscape, a makeup counter at the Bullring Shopping Centre. However, I'm with a man called Julian Treasure, who thinks this is simply bad for business.
There's a big rule that retailers often don't understand, which is that music on top of noise is generally just more noise. It's like putting perfume on a bad smell. You just get a worse smell.
And to prove his point, he is secretly experimenting on the frazzled Christmas shoppers of Birmingham. Two identical locations, one is being given a pop soundtrack. The other gets soundtrack calm.
That's wonderful. It feels really soothing.
Makes me feel more relaxed and, yeah, sleepy.
As we came along, you could feel the difference.
I don't like loud music when I'm shopping.
I like it. No, it's cool and hip.
Hands up if you prefer this sound.
I don't believe it.
This honestly can't be better.
Yes, it is bad.
Dance to this, you can't dance.
You can't dance down there.
You don't want to be dancing in shopping, do you?
Yes.
But this is about more than just loud speakers in malls. It's a growing realisation that business is good on looks, but not so good with sound. Cavernous public spaces with hard surfaces are too noisy. But equally, some places are too quiet.
I mean, I've been in offices where the turning of a piece of paper is a major event. So there, you do need some masking sound put in. And the best one, actually, we believe for offices generally, is to put in office babble.
Understandably, you pipe in the sound of people talking?
Yeah, gently, so that it masks conversations more than a couple of metres away.
Of course, brands think about sound when it comes to jingles. Take Intel.
I think if I asked any listener to this to draw Intel's logo, they'd be challenged, but most people can go, da 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 da. It's worth hundreds of millions of dollars to Intel, that sound. And that's only
it's
one
worth
aspect.
Hundreds of millions of dollars?
Hundreds of millions of dollars, yes. It's a huge part of their brand.
And have there been any bad ones?
A few years ago, Mercedes developed an extremely strange sonic logo, like a little piece out of the soundtrack of some horror film. Another good example would be the French railway system SNCF. It kind of goes dun, 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 dun. Recently, Dave Gilmour, the guitarist from Pink Floyd, was on a French railway station and heard that and really liked it. So he's actually written a whole song around that sonic logo.
But the effect of sound environments is still in its infancy. Julian's theory on what works best is WWB. Wind, water and birds. Nature, in other words. And he says it even works with the call of nature.
You can do wonderful things in toilets. We have shown, for example, in service station toilets. We did a project for BP some years ago, and by improving the environment in there and playing, actually it was birdsong in those toilets, customer satisfaction went up 50%.
This is a customer announcement. Customers are reminded to keep their baggage with them at all times.
Meanwhile, back at the Bullring, Peter Cooper from Hammerson, who's in charge of the look and feel of 11 malls across Britain, was now watching the shoppers in our two sound zones.
Hardly anybody's actually noticing the speakers. They're just walking, doing their thing. They're happy with where they're off to, and nothing is impacting on their behaviour. But here, people are both looking and changing direction at the same time.
Can you imagine a day when they turn off the pop music?
Yes. I can imagine a day when shopping centres sound quite different, when they interact with people on a sensory level which is more calming, and we can start to tune our buildings to make them feel better.
The BBC's David Sillitoe in Birmingham, England for us. So we were just talking about music and retail. Chances are that if you've spent time in the past month or so in a retail shop of almost any kind, you've heard a song by a group called Mannheim Steamroller, or maybe two songs, or 100 songs for that matter. Those New Age Christmas carols, classical compositions with electric guitars and harps and electronics and all kinds of stuff. The group's success is amazing. 10 gold records, 8 platinum, and yet Mannheim Steamroller is pretty much one guy, one very successful guy. His name is Chip Davis. He lives in Omaha, Nebraska. We called him up. Chip, welcome to the program.
Happy to be here.
This is a very big number, so I'm going to let you say it. Exactly how many albums have you sold?
Oh, gosh. I think probably just a little north of 50 million.
Do you suppose it's possible that you're the least known 50 million album seller, like, on the whole planet?
Very likely, and that may be why we're selling so many, because, like, I never wear out because nobody knows who I am.
Well, and how did that come to pass? Because you've been around for a long time. Mannheim Steamroller's been around for a long time, and people love your music, but you're very under the radar.
You know, I had an alter ego. I was writing all the music for C.W. McCall back in the early 70s, and we sold about 20 million of those. You probably remember the big hit Convoy.
Oh, yeah.
During that time, you know, I saw that once it got branded and everybody knew who it was, that it's real hard to be a chameleon and change your complexion and be able to show up as in different forms. So I went under Mannheim Steamroller instead of Chip Davis.
Do me a favor, and for those who are not perhaps familiar with it out there, describe what it is that you do, specifically with the Christmas music. You take these songs that are hundreds of years old and you jazz them up a little bit.
You know, what I do is take a Christmas carol that's known in a certain way, and then I'll completely change what the perception is. Like, for the most radical I did was Jingle Bells. I did it as a big, beautiful orchestral slow ballad.
Well, as you were sitting there in the studio doing this, were you thinking, I'm going to throw some, you know, lute music in here, and I'm going to put an organ over there? I mean,
that's what we get after we sell a whole bunch of them. We get a lot of lute. Sorry, I couldn't help myself there. But yeah, I love the Renaissance period, and that actually is where a lot of our Christmas carols that we know today come from. So I like to take different carols back to their time, but then I'd rock them out like in Mannheim them.
I'd Mannheim them. You've become a verb. Is it true that when you first started Mannheim Steamroller and your first album, Fresh Air, is it true that the major labels sort of didn't know what to do with you and you had to go figure out your own way to sell this stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. Because of the C.W. McCall success, I was able to get in to actually see the right guys. I took it around to a number of the major labels. I flew to New York and L.A. and different places and presented it. And then they said, well, we'll have a meeting about it and we'll decide what we're going to do with you. Well, there wasn't a retail space for what I was doing yet. Nobody had thought of this new age or eclectic music category. So invariably, the statement I would get would be something like, you know, we really love your music. We'd love to take it, but we don't have a way to sell it.
And then you went out and started your own label.
Yeah, it started American Gramophone Records. And first Christmas album sold 9 million copies, like sort of right off the bat. Everybody was shocked.
You also sort of do a whole lot more, I guess, direct marketing than most traditional music labels do, right? I mean, you're out there in actual physical stores and stuff.
Yes, we're still in, you know, as they refer to as bricks and mortar.
Yeah.
And I might mention that, you know, this last year, our sales are just amazing for as long as we've been around.
When you're driving around or just hanging around in your house, do you listen to yourself on the stereo? Or?
Well, typically my TVs are all on some music channel and my stuff pops up on there. And I'm always like flattered and stunned that I'm still getting that airplay. That's kind of cool.
Chip Davis is Mannheim Steamroller, basically. Chip, thanks very much.
You bet. It's my pleasure. Thank you very much for the interview.
This final note on the way out today, which technically broke yesterday, but I'm going to allow it. Kim Kardashian apparently has a new app. It's called the Kimoji app. Yes, it's emojis a la Kardashian. Use your mind's eye. You can kind of imagine what they are going to be. I personally don't get the appeal, but as I have said before, she is an amazing businesswoman. Something out of nothing. Alrighty, we gotta go. The Dow up 165 points today, about 0.9%. The NASDAQ up 32.6% on that particular index. The S&P 500 added 17.8%. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. The senior digital producer is Nishat Kurwa. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.